Yes, good morning. Michael Traylor for the appellants in this matter. I have reserved 5 minutes with the court. Okay. I probably won't need all of it, but just in case.
Thank you. You can proceed.
All right, thank you. May it please the court, I first wanted to address the court's the issues the court raised in its order of July 28th regarding the jurisdictional issues in this matter. The court mentioned the Green Tree case, and in that case, Justice Rehnquist, in the very first two sentences, in fact, said that an order compelling arbitration and dismissing a party's underlying claims is a final decision with respect to an arbitration with the meaning of Section 16 of the FAA, and thus is immediately appealable under the Act.
That principle doesn't apply, though, to a stay. And so the question that I have is, what actually did the district court intend to be doing here? Because although the complaint was dismissed without prejudice, the colloquy was, well, that the court viewed it as the equivalent of a stay, and at one point even said that he intended to retain jurisdiction. So what do we do with that ambiguity?
Yes, happy to address that, Your Honor. So the court dismissed the case, certainly. In fact, that was the relief that was requested in the motion. It was the relief that the respondents put in their proposed order, and it was the order of the court. The court then confirmed that with the parties in the transcript. He asked both parties, are you okay with a dismissal?
And both that isn't responsive to my question, though. Isn't there an ambiguity here in the sense that the court said, I'm not required to dismiss it, and this is, in my view, going to be equivalent to a stay because you can come back to me?
I don't believe it's ambiguous because I believe what the court was addressing when it mentioned that, and the court went on to talk about the ability of the parties to come back if there were any other issues, and specifically mentioned using Rule 60 as a post-dismissal vehicle that the parties could use to come back. I think the court was very clear that its intent was to dismiss the case as was requested and agreed upon by the parties, but he did mention that the parties could come back under Rule 60. The court mentioned not having to have to worry about maintaining jurisdiction and doing status conferences and things of that nature. I believe the court was very clear that the intent was to dismiss.
But the order explicitly says the court will treat it as functionally indistinguishable from a stay. So should we just disregard that language?
No, I think if we continue to read after that, he explains in a manner similar to what's noted in the Smith versus Spazzeri case, what he meant by that, right? What he meant by that was if there's an issue, the parties can use Rule 60 to come back, right? But I think the court certainly was aware of the distinction between the two.
But the court said that they didn't have, that nobody would have to meet the requirements of Rule 60, if I'm remembering that correctly. He mentioned it, but he didn't say the parties had to follow it.
He certainly mentioned that there would be a relaxed review under Rule 60. But all of that still bodes for what the order was, which was a dismissal. He said he was treating it as no different from a stay and went on to say that the parties could come back under Rule 60.
But he said in terms of the party's ability to seek confirmation, and that's more consistent with the supervisory role of retaining jurisdiction over the arbitration, isn't it?
I agree that it's consistent with that, but I don't think the order was ambiguous at all. He dismissed the case, very clearly.
Okay, but you would agree that if the court had stayed the action pending arbitration, that this would not be appealable. Is that right?
Correct.
Okay.
Continuing on, I mentioned the Smith versus Spazzeri case. And ironically, in that case, there's a mention somewhat humorously that says, shall mean shall and stay means stay. And in this case, our position is that dismiss means dismiss. That is what was requested. That is what was ordered. That was confirmed and agreed upon by both of the parties. And we believe that resolves any ambiguity. The second issue raised by the court this court in the July 28th order was whether or not some more recent decisions mandated entry of a stay versus a dismissal, looking at the Jules versus Andre Velaz props case. And that case looked specifically at the statute under Section 3 of the Arbitration Act, Federal Arbitration Act. And that language is very specific. It gives the party seeking to compel arbitration the choice, right? If they request a stay, then they are entitled to them. Here, they did not request a stay. They requested a dismissal. And it's repeated throughout the moving papers in connection with the request for the stay. If we look at excerpts of record, volume 3 at page 226, at page 234, at page 240, and at page 252 in the proposed order, the only relief they sought was a dismissal. They did not request a stay. So then under Section 3, the court, that mandatory language would not apply because it's twofold. There has to be a request for a stay and then a decision of a stay, and neither one of those things happened in this case. So we would argue under both of those concerns that the court mentioned in the July 28th order, that this court has jurisdiction and that the dismissal should be treated as a dismissal for purposes of this appeal. If I move on to the merits, I do want to start off noting that a memorandum was issued, and I apologize if you all know this, by the Ninth Circuit yesterday in San Diego in a case, Ricks, R-I-C-K-E-S, versus Thermo Fisher. This spoke about the need for actual assent for an arbitration agreement and said that an email sending of an arbitration agreement was not enough. And I just wanted to call the court's attention to that. I'm not suggesting this precedent, but it came down last night while I was preparing, and I did want to at least bring that to the court's order. But it's very consistent with our argument here that it does require mutual assent. We have these concepts that we learned starting in law school, voluntary affirmative conduct, the mutual assent, the meeting of the minds, and things of that nature. And with respect to the arbitration clause, that just did not happen. This was an oral agreement made over the telephone. It was solicited over the telephone. It was concluded over the telephone. Payment was made over the telephone. The subsequent sending of an email, that email having a link, that link going to a web page that has dynamic terms and conditions which can be modified and changed at any time, is not a meeting of the minds. It is not evident of mutual assent. And the burden here is on the respondents to show by a preponderance of the evidence that there was mutual assent. They're unable to do so in this case because the deal was made and concluded over the phone.
Counsel, if this case does proceed to arbitration, would the arbitrator have the opportunity to determine whether it is in fact arbitrable based on your arguments to us?
You know, I don't recall offhand if the arbitration agreement empowered the arbitrator with that. Ironically, I have another case against the same company where an employee arbitration agreement does say, and it's super, super ironic. I'm actually, when I leave here, I'm on second call on that very issue, on whether language in the arbitration agreement giving the power to do that to the arbitrator is enforceable. I don't believe that language is in this proposed arbitration agreement. But given the current posture of the case, I certainly believe the court here has jurisdiction to make such a determination. The representations were made on the phone, the terms were discussed on the phone, the prices were quoted on the phone, the parties agreed by phone, and payment was taken by phone. This is the epitome of a meeting of the minds and a deal that was closed.
But wasn't there a statement in that call that there would be an email forthcoming with terms and conditions?
Respondents contend that that is their normal process, but we don't have a salesperson presenting any evidence that happened in connection with these particular parties. The preponderance of the evidence is on them. There's no declaration that says, I spoke to this person on such and such a date, and I stated that, right? And even in such of a situation, I would argue that, you know, sending an email later that contradicts potentially the terms of a deal is just not enforceable.
Well, contradicts, was there a call saying you'll never have to arbitrate? Don't worry about that.
No, but
that isn't part of what I understood.
No, as we mentioned in our papers, there are other provisions of the terms and conditions, if you will, that we do believe contradict the terms of the agreement, not specifically the arbitration, because arbitration wasn't mentioned in the telephone call. But we do believe there are other terms and conditions on that dynamic web page that contradict the simple deal that the parties made here.
Is it your position that on a motion to compel arbitration, the district court can't look outside the pleadings?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear that.
Is it your position that when ruling on a motion to compel arbitration, a district court can only look at the pleadings? Is that your position?
The district court, I believe, can consider any evidence before it. I wouldn't propose that is limited. I'm saying in this particular case, no such evidence was submitted.
Okay, thank you, because I thought your brief was suggesting that it's like a 12B and you only look at the four corners of the complaint. But you're saying that's not your argument. It's just that in this case, you didn't think there was anything else.
Correct. My 12B argument is that our allegations that this is an oral agreement must be taken as accurate. We did not assert or allege a written agreement. And I think if there's part of the argument coming from the respondent says, no, this wasn't. This was a written agreement done later that incorporated I think those potential defenses for purpose of 12B, I believe the district court did have to take take the pleadings as being factual from that standpoint. But I'm not suggesting they don't have the right to look at any evidence.
Did you want to reserve the rest of your time for rebuttal?
I believe so.
It's up to you.
The last point I would want to make is and I appreciate that, Your Honor, the respondent's brief talks about Civil Code Section 1625 as part of the argument. And again, in that statute, it refers to the execution of a contract in writing. And again, we just did not have that. So this notion of the writing becoming some integration of something when it was never executed or even specifically agreed to by the appellants, we believe, invalidates any argument that is applicable. Thank you. I'll reserve the rest of my 2 minutes.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Come on.
May I proceed, Your Honor?
Yes.
Thank you. Adam Unikowski on behalf of the defendant, Appellee Move, Inc.
Could you speak up or bring the microphone closer?
Yes.
Thank you.
My name is Adam Unikowski, and I'm here on behalf of the defendant, Appellee Move, Inc.
Great.
This court should dismiss the appeal for lack of jurisdiction because there is no final decision in this case. But if the court exercises jurisdiction, it should affirm for the reasons stated by the district court.
Okay. Well, just to get right to it, as your friend on the other side just pointed out, you agreed to dismissal. That's what you wanted. You didn't request a stay. So, I mean, why doesn't that sort of undercut your argument now that we don't have jurisdiction?
I guess, first of all, this court has an independent obligation to assess jurisdiction. It's not a waivable issue. And so I think even though it's true that we agreed at the order during the hearing to what the district court denominated as a dismissal, I think we thought we were agreeing to a stay because the court said that there would be no difference between a dismissal and a stay. And, you know, this court's in-bank case in WMX holds that not all dismissals without prejudice are appealable orders. Some are, some aren't. And to make sure that it's appealable, you have to look at the whole record to make sure that the case really is final as opposed to the district court leaving the suit pending for further proceedings. And here I think that's exactly what the court did. The court is saying at the hearing that you can still come back to me. And then the court says you won't have to meet a Rule 60 standard, which is the ordinary standard that's applicable when there's a final judgment, other than to let me know and remind me that I've retained jurisdiction. The very concept of retaining jurisdiction implies that the case is not over, that the court is contemplating that there's going to be additional proceedings.
You agree that the district court here sort of abdicated its responsibility to supervise the arbitration because it said, I don't want to be bothered with status reports. I don't want to be bothered with status conferences. You all just go away.
I think that if the parties had come back, if there was some problem in the arbitration, they couldn't agree to an arbitrator or something, I imagine the court would have stepped in. I think what the court is saying is that it didn't want needless status reports saying we're still arbitrating. The court just contemplated that there was going to be an arbitration, and the next time the parties would come back would be when the arbitration was over, and then the court would either confirm or vacate the award. But I don't see the court as saying...
But isn't that inconsistent with the Supreme Court cases that talk about the FAA envisions district courts having this supervisory role on subpoenas and other things? And this is saying, I don't want to be bothered.
You know, I don't think the court is saying that it's just not going to be bothered and is foreclosing the parties from coming back. I mean, the court referred back to some prior cases that it had decided where, quote, I have to keep track of it, I have to have status reports, and ultimately some status conferences. And then the court says it serves no purpose. So I think the court had in mind a case in which the parties were arbitrating, and they just had to come back to the district court every 6 months and said, you know, we're still going, without any meaningful role from the district court. That's what I think it wanted to avoid.
But it imposed a Rule 60 obligation.
No, the court's saying...
That's not... It might have said, I'll give you a more lenient Rule 60 standard, but it still said, you got to file a motion to reopen.
I view maybe that part of the transcript a little ambiguous. The court says you won't have to meet a Rule 60 standard. The court says just file a motion to reopen. I don't really view that as saying I'm issuing a final judgment and then you have to file a Rule 60 motion. I mean, it's true the court later says, you know, if you do cite Rule 60, so it's a little bit ambiguous in that discussion.
No, I don't think it's ambiguous. He says just file a motion to reopen. You won't have to meet a Rule 60 standard. Other than to let me know and remind me that I've retained jurisdiction, we're moving to reopen. I think it's pretty clear.
I'm not sure.
But let me ask you, it seems that Jules has in many different locations in that opinion saying that a district court is basically required to stay in action by statute when it refers a case to arbitration. So why isn't this dismissal an error?
So on this issue, I agree with my colleague's analysis, actually. The Jules case just refers back to Smith versus Spazzieri, and Smith versus Spazzieri says repeatedly that it's upon request of a party the court has to issue a stay. That's consistent with the language of Section 3 of the FAA, which refers to an application of a party. It is true that the Jules case doesn't repeat that language, but I kind of view Jules as pithily summarizing Smith versus Spazzieri rather than enlarging its holding and saying that a stay is required even when not requested by a party.
But you would agree in the language where it says a court has to stay it, under Section 3, it doesn't say if it's requested by...
That's right. That footnote that the
court... It doesn't mention the request by party.
Definitely. Yeah, that's correct. The footnote that the court cited in its order from last week does not mention that. So the question is whether it's altering the holding of Smith versus Pizzeri or just kind of pithily summarizing it without mentioning that extra element. I don't read that footnote as altering the holding. I do think the Jules case is helpful to us in a different way. So the holding of the Jules case is that a court that... issues a Section 3 stay, retains jurisdiction to confirm or vacate the arbitration award. And importantly, the court says that the court's jurisdiction to vacate or confirm springs from the same source as the jurisdiction it initially exercised. Maybe put more artfully, when a court stays a case and then confirms or vacates the award, it's the same case. It's a continuation of the original case, which implies that the case is not over until there is this final decision confirming or vacating the award. I do understand in this case the court denominated its order a dismissal, but when the court is saying it's going to retain jurisdiction, which is the words during the hearing, then I think the court is saying it's really keeping the case and exercising the same jurisdiction when the parties come back, which means the case is not really over. And, you know, in terms of the hearing, it's true that we didn't at the hearing say, please stay the case, but like we had no reason to do it because the judge is telling us there will be no difference between a stay or a dismissal. So,
well, your written motion didn't request a stay.
That's true. The written motion did not. But then at the hearing, the court is saying, let me just tell you, there'll be no difference between a stay and a dismissal. And so we had no reason to push back there. But ultimately, I think the question is not what the written motion says, it's what the district court actually did. And we understand the district court to have issued a stay. And the dismissal should be treated kind of like the administrative closure in Deese versus Billy, which the court held was not sufficient basis to confer appellate jurisdiction.
I had one other question, and this is referring to the colloquy about retaining jurisdiction on page 37 of the record. When the court says, just file a motion to reopen, that's a full sentence, full stop. Is there any other way to file a motion to reopen other than under Rule 60? Because he then goes on to say, well, you don't have to meet the standards. You know, and if you decide to, you can cite Rule 60. But I just was wondering if there is any other avenue.
I interpret that statement to just be a not a reference necessarily to Rule 60, but just a motion in the court to, you know, lift the stay. Like, in general, if a court issues a stay pending arbitration, the way it works is the parties go to arbitration, the arbitration is done, and then the parties go back to the district court and ask to reactivate the case. And you might call that a motion to reopen if the case was administratively closed during the pendency of the arbitration. That's what I understand this court to, the court to have referred
so
to.
If I understand your answer correctly, there is an avenue that does not walk through Rule 60 at all that would have been available given what the court said here.
Yeah, it's what the court would have done if there was a stay. We think this is a stay, but in an ordinary case where the court announces from the bench, I'm issuing a stay under Section 3, maybe there's an administrative closure like in Deese versus Billy. What happens is the parties go to arbitration and then they wrap up and they come back to the district court and say, okay, there's been this event, the arbitration award, please reopen the case, reactivate the case, and let's resume. And that's not a Rule 60 motion. It's just a motion to lift the case from stasis and start litigating again. That's what I think the court was saying when it said motion to reopen. I don't interpret that as a Rule 60 motion. I mean, Rule 60 itself doesn't use the word reopen. I don't think it's like relief from judgment or something. So that's what I understood the court to be saying.
So there are two cases, published ones, that say a dismissal without prejudice under this statute is a final decision. And one even says a stay is a final decision. So why shouldn't that decide this case?
I don't think there's one that says a stay is a final decision. 9 U.S.C. Section 16 says this: a stay pending arbitration is not appealable. It's true that the John...
That's what's happened in that case, though, correct?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
That's what happened in that case, though.
No, I don't think there's a case in which the district court issued a stay and that was held to be an appealable order. The John Mohammadi case does involve a dismissal, and that dismissal was held to be appealable. But I don't think...
But the International Alliance of Theatrical Stage Employee and Moving Picture Technicians, Artists, and Allied, it's a very long name for a case, that one, there was a stay.
I'd have to look at that case.
Pending the completion of arbitration.
9 U.S.C. section... Sorry, Your Honor.
Go ahead.
I want to take another look. 9 U.S.C. Section 16 explicitly says that stays pending arbitration are not considered final appealable orders. So I'd want to take another look at the case that Your Honor is referring to. The John Mohammadi case does say that a dismissal without prejudice is an appealable order, but I don't interpret that decision as saying that all dismissals are invariably appealable. That would conflict with the WMX case that says that some are and some aren't.
But you agree that the International Alliance case says that a dismissal without prejudice is a final decision for purposes of this statute, right?
I think there may be language saying that a dismissal without prejudice is final, but I don't think all dismissals without prejudice, are created alike. And there is an in-bank decision from this court that says that when the court uses the phrase dismissal without prejudice, you've got to look at the whole record to see what really happened. And this is not an ordinary dismissal without prejudice. It's a dismissal without prejudice in which the court goes out of its way to say that it's retaining jurisdiction. And so that looks like the dismissal without prejudice in WMX, where there's language in the order saying, and by the way, I'm granting leave to amend the complaint, implying that the court anticipates further proceedings, even though it labeled its order a dismissal without prejudice.
Well, I'll just represent to you, International Alliance involves a stay. And it interprets the Supreme Court's decision in Greentree as basically saying there is appellate review.
Okay, I'll
when all the claims and when all the claims in a case go to arbitration, there's appellate review. That's what that case says, and it is published.
Okay, I'll write a letter to the court if with leave of the court to.
No, you don't have to do that. I'm just asking you.
If I may turn to the merits in my remaining time, we think the district court got this case right. The district court correctly concluded that the parties had entered into a contract with a binding arbitration agreement and therefore did not err in compelling arbitration. I'd like to address the Ricks versus Thermo Fisher case, the non-precedential opinion the court issued yesterday, which I also came across this morning in my preparation for today's argument. So in that decision, the facts were that there was an employee who was working for the employer, and during the course of the employment relationship, he got an email, which he never opened, with an arbitration agreement. And the court said that no contract was formed at all because he just never opened this email, period. That's different from this case because there's definitely a contract that was formed. The only question is, what did the contract say? And so the plaintiff alleges that it was an oral contract that could be separated from the written agreement, but I don't think that's right in view of both what happened during the conversation and what the written agreement says. So in the oral conversation, the sales consultant from Move makes clear that the order says on the phone that the order confirmation contains complete details, including the terms and conditions of their full and complete contract. That's in the standard operating procedures, which are signed by the sales consultants. And in fact, we submitted signed standard operating procedure documents by the sales consultants who interacted with the plaintiffs in this case. And so, and that's not controverted. The declarations from the plaintiff do not say that the sales consultants didn't say that. All they say is that the sales consultants didn't specifically mention the arbitration agreement, which isn't necessary, as the district court correctly held. So the conversation on the phone in which the contract was formed specifically refers to the forthcoming terms and conditions. And then the terms and conditions arrive, and they contain an arbitration agreement, and they also contain an integration clause that supersedes the prior oral statement. So I think under well-settled California law, it's the written agreement that constitutes the contract, and that contains an arbitration agreement. And the terms and conditions document were clearly linked in the email in this interaction between sophisticated professionals and Move. This court has a number of cases saying that a clear link, in clear font to the terms and conditions, gives sufficient notice to the other side of the transaction. And I think those cases are dispositive here. The court has no further questions. We'd ask the court to dismiss the appeal or alternatively to affirm.
Thank you very much. Okay, you have about 2.5 minutes for rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you again. Just very briefly, I did want to point out the language in Section 3 of the Arbitration Act. It does state, not that if the court finds the issue is arbitrable, there shall be a stay. It says, upon request of the party seeking arbitration, there will be a stay. Again, here, there was no such request.
Well, it doesn't. One way to interpret that is simply that if the parties choose to stay in court, they can. That is, arbitration itself is not mandatory. So why wouldn't that be an appropriate reading of the section to say that if a party doesn't want to stay in court, then a stay is and there's an arbitration provision, the stay is required.
I believe that the statute states that the stay must be requested.
Well, it says on application of a party, but I guess what I'm trying to get at is there's another way to read the statute and that gives it complete meaning, which is if you happen to know that there's an arbitration agreement, but nobody wants to go to arbitration, you don't have to send it there. But if somebody asks, you issue a stay.
I see which Your Honor is stating. I just think we're working too hard to try to get to the point of a stay here.
I'm just trying to understand what the Supreme Court might have had in mind in its most recent footnote, and that's all I'm getting at. I'm not working to get to a particular result.
When I say working, I mean the argument itself, not saying anyone personally. But that footnote refers to the Section 3, which has ultimately two requirements, right? Finding of a basis for an compelling arbitration and a request. And without both of those things, I mean, this area of law is very heavily favored for parties seeking arbitration. They have the power, and they didn't exercise. If they had requested a stay, they might have a chance to get one. If they had said to Judge Bloomfield, who's been on the bench a significant time and has a significant history as a judge, he knows the difference. If they had said, no, we want to stay, I believe he may have given it to him. But everyone agreed, the judge and all the parties agreed, that this case was proper for dismissal, and it was dismissed. And I think to try to refigure that language and make it something else, when it's very clear what he did, we should shy away from. This is a area of law, the right to a jury trial should be subject to strict scrutiny. The preponderance of the evidence is on the respondents, and they haven't met it. And this court should look at this very critically from a jurisdictional standpoint and specifically from the enforcement standpoint. And the respondents have just not met their burden on the merits. And Judge Blumenfeld's order is very clear that he dismissed the case.
Okay.
And we would submit on that basis. And I thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. We thank both counsel for their helpful arguments in this case. And this matter is now submitted. Thank you.
Thank you.